Welcome, everyone, to Capes and Scowls, issue 2.5. 2.5. Thank you for coming back. We appreciate it. We know you love us because you're back and you're listening to us yet again, which is fantastic. Or maybe this is your first ever issue, in which case you have a lot in store for you because you're going to do some learning real quick. So we're going to just do some reviews of comics, and we are going to kick it off with Nat.
So I'm going to do something a little bit unorthodox today. I'm going to review a storyline in its entirety as opposed to a singular comic book for this. It's going to be the Button storyline, which is Batman 21 and 22 and Flash 21 and 22. Overall, really enjoyed this. It's a weird story in the sense that it probably takes place over the course of 15 minutes. The entirety of the four issues. Issue one takes place over the course of a minute, and they follow suit after that. The first issue is the strongest. It's an unfortunate thing that it doesn't end strong, but it's a precursor more than anything else, and I think that's also its biggest weakness. This is a storyline that really is just set up for what is going to come in the rest of DC Comics Rebirth. It just confirms or leads us in the direction that we're all thinking, that the Watchmen are going to be integrated into the DCU somehow, whether or not they're going to be continual players or just the explanation of why the New 52 existed and why the New 52 was quite a bit different from the previous versions of the DC universe. At the end of Flash 22, there is the image of the Doomsday Clock, which appears to be the next big miniseries. For those of you familiar with Watchmen, the Doomsday Clock is part of the story, and there at the 12 o'clock is the Superman symbol. So that could mean many things. Obviously, it's going to mean Superman's involvement in the story, but Doomsday happens to also be the character who killed Superman in the pre-New 52 universe. So, great. This overall, like I said, it ends weak.
He's looking through the pages right now, and
sorry, that's I'm a huge Watchmen fan. Yeah. That's the first ever graphic novel I ever read, and I'm just, I'm over here.
I will say the art in this is really, really strong. I think the Flash art is honestly better, but I'm more of a cartoony style, and that is from Howard Porter, does the penciling and inks on the Flash issues.
Fun fact, though, about the Doomsday Clock, it is still around, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. They keep moving it closer to midnight and further away from midnight. So, for those of you not familiar, the Doomsday Clock is the... I forget who runs it, but it's pretty much, like, an estimation of how close we are to annihilating ourselves as people.
Yeah.
It was a big thing in the Cold War. But they still have it around, so, sleep well tonight.
I will say, go ahead, if you're a fan of either of these characters. I don't normally read The Flash, but I did for this little micro story. I'm excited for what's to come in DC Rebirth. So, yeah, I would say thumbs up, good read.
All right. Pat, what do you got over there? Besides watching the final issue.
Yeah, looking at the lenticular cover. And...
Yeah, so I'm over here just mystified by the Flash's lenticular cover. So I'm going to go ahead and start off with The Wicked and Divine. This is, I feel like most comic fans have certain stories that they only pick up in trades just to see the whole story arc unwind. And usually Wicked and Divine is one of those for me. I pick up the trades when it comes out. Amazing story, but you kind of have to take it in big chunks. However, they just did a one-shot issue that takes place in 455 AD. So most of Wicked and Divine is modern-day times. This one, we go back to ancient Rome. And so for those of us familiar with the Wicked and Divine storyline, it's about gods who are reincarnated every 90 or so years, I think. So this is one of the early iterations of this reincarnation. And it goes back, and what was really interesting for me is not just to see, they did an amazing job with the time, with like the setting or whatever, there's a great little quip in here about the Vandals that come to sack Rome, and one of the characters is like, I'm sure that in the future, Vandal will be synonymous with wisdom, and and for us, you know, hindsight, you know, 1600 years in the future, we're like, ha ha ha. but it was pretty, so that was interesting. Really cool setting and stuff like this. But what's really interesting about this issue for the sake of Wicked and Divine fans is we have this thing in the regular storyline that happens. One of the biggest things is that I've been wondering this whole time that I'm sure a lot of people have, which is why the gods have to die after pretty much like 2 years of reincarnation. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of just like a thing about being a god in the Wicked and Divine. You only have 2 years and then that's it. You're toast. You're done. Dead. And so it's like not, we're not sure if like that's just like the timeline or if something happens or like Ananke, she's kind of like doing some sketchy stuff, so we're not sure what she's up to really. And this issue really goes into an explanation on what happens to these reincarnations of the gods after 2 years, pretty much. So Ananke, we have this guy who's Lucifer, the reincarnation of Lucifer back in this iteration, and he pretty much becomes Emperor of Rome for a while due to his powers. We have he's like ruling the Senate and ruling the people and stuff like this, and he doesn't die after 2 years. Ananke warns him that something might happen, and he's like, I don't want to listen to you, you old bitch, like, pretty much. And so then we get this, I think I showed both of you guys this page earlier,
it's a harp.
Yeah, it's a harp. It's one of the, as you could hear from Nat and Leander, it's like turning the page, everybody is just, don't eat before you read this issue.
Or while you're eating.
Yeah, especially while you're eating this. Probably like, I would give it a good hour before you go swimming in this issue. it definitely gives us a very, very graphic reason as to why the gods are only around for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And after this, I'm like, yep, they got 2 years and then they're out. That's a good run of fame. Uh-huh. And then it's done.
Oh jeez.
So Wicked and Divine 455 AD is a standalone issue that just came out. I honestly kind of hope that they might go for do some more of these kind of flashback things. It'd be interesting to see if they do one-offs.
Curious now, would you think about jumping into the individual titles after this, or are you going to stay with trades for the main title?
I think I'm going to buy this most recent trade because I think it's coming out very soon, or it's already come out. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably going to buy this next trade, and then we'll see how it goes from there. I have a feeling that it's still going to be, because the story is very compelling, very well done, but like I said, it's just one of those things that you would rather take in, or at least me personally would rather take in big chunks.
Cool. Yeah, certain comics are like that, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
It totally makes sense. I've only read Saga in that format, so I've never read single issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me neither, actually. Yeah. Just trades.
Yeah, it seems to make sense.
I hear that that's actually pretty common. I don't know, like, anybody that... Like, I know everybody's a huge fan of Saga, but I don't know anybody that actually reads the individual things.
You know what's funny is the subscription count's really high, so I'm wondering if people actually get it and put it in a bag and board and stick it in their box and then read the trade paperbacks when they come out. So the collective aspect happens.
That makes sense. Well, I want to jump into Generation X number one, and I'm going to take some time. I'm going to gently caress this as I give it to you, because this is good stuff. Because Generation X, more importantly, Jubilee is in there, and you guys know how much I love Jubilee. And if you don't know, now you know. So Generation X number one, written by Christina Strain. So we got a female author, Almachar Pina is the artist, and I think overall the cast is pretty interesting. So the idea of Generation X, I like the way it starts out, because obviously the idea is that Jubilee is going to be leading this new team, and the idea is that she's really kind of doing some self-reflection in the very beginning, like, this is where I thought my life was going to be, and this is not where my life is, and but I'm still trying my best to make it work, and now I have a kid, and how do I make that work? And in the very beginning, she's in Central Park, and she's already lost her kid. So that's, like, classic, like, Jubilee, like, you think of her as, a, like, a mall rat, and now she's this adult that has a kid. But even having the kid was an unexpected situation. So she's trying to live her life the best she can with this idea that she has a kid and she wants to help out at the Xavier Institute or at the Jean Grey School. And so is it Xavier Institute now or Jean Grey School? I forget.
I think it's back to being Xavier.
Yeah, I think it's back at Xavier. And I really like the beginning because it shows Jubilee and it shows Jono, which is Chamber, for those of you who are Generation X fans. And I like the fact that those two characters are interacting together, just as a kind of toss back to the Generation X era. And how far they've come, actually, since the first Generation X came out to now. The fact that there's a point where Jono accidentally shows his power, and, like, no one's really freaking out. They're a little like, whoa, but, like, no one's like, kill the mutant, you know, situation. Which is what life was like when Generation X, the first series, came out, which is pretty cool. The artwork is a little, it took me a second to get used to, because Jubilee looks a little, she looks more Asian.
Right.
Which is cool. But I think that's what they were going for, but it also has a little, they over-dramatize it a little bit, slightly, for me anyways, for my own taste, but I think I'm gonna be okay with it, ultimately. And then it basically enters into this new kid entering into Xavier Institute. He's brand new student, he's registering, he's trying to go around to find what's going on, and they find basically this kid, you show his progression walking through the school, bumping into other students, and his power is, I think is called is when he touches someone, he can see their past, basically. So it's really interesting, and I know the name of it, psychometry, whatever you want to call it. You can call it whatever you want. And so it's a really interesting power, but you can imagine that, like, in combat, it's probably not very useful to have that kind of power. Like, what are you going to do with that power when you're fighting Magneto?
I don't know. You could just be like, remember that one time your parents did this thing to you? And then all of a sudden they're like, my mommy never loved me.
Right, exactly. That's probably the best you can do.
You got to be really quick about that, though.
That is true.
I feel like in, like, a Magneto battle.
This is the character that would be the interrogator, in my
The
opinion.
Interrogator. Yeah. Perfect, right.
Well, cause
but probably not in the field.
No, not in the field, yeah.
I feel like X-Men does have a lot of those, though. Like, they have the field teams that go out and kick ass with their powers, and then they have the people back at the school that, you know, do the mental kneecapping pretty much.
Right, exactly. So here's my favorite part of this. So there's a point when Jubilee goes in to talk to Kitty Pryde, who's now the headmaster of, or headmistress, however you want to call it, and is really cool scene that reminds you that Jubilee is still a vampire. And so she's going through and she's super busy. She just got done with, like, losing her kid. Now she's trying to figure out how to be a mentor for these other kids. And she's going through her bag to get her juice for Shogo, which is her son, and she pulls out the juice and she's about to feed the baby, and Kitty's like, wait, are you sure that's what you meant to give him? And she looks at it and she's like, it's a bottle of blood that she drinks, and she was about to give it to Shogo, who's not a vampire. And it was a really amazing, cool, like, fun, like, little piece of it, and it shows, like, being a single mom, people tend to, like, get on you, like, oh, are you fit? Are you whatever? She's like, I'm just tired. I had a rough day. I had a long day. I'll figure it out. Everything's fine. Don't downgrade me just because I made one mistake, you know? I can still be everything that I want to be. So anyways, the rest of the book goes basically through this new character introducing to the school. He basically gets to his classroom, and you see Bling, who's a mutant character, get thrown through a wall. And you're like, what is going on? He's like, what's going on? And you basically see Quentin and Bling having a fight because Bling accidentally scuffed Quentin's shoe. And so because of that, they do all this damage and craziness. You get introduced to some of the other characters, Nature Girl, who can control animals in some way, or nature. And then you see Eye Boy, and you're like, all right, I'm starting to get a sense that these are characters who probably aren't really that amazing in battle, except for Quentin. Quentin probably can handle his own because he can handle himself against the Phoenix. And it's really about showing how Jubilee is trying to say, you know what? I may have a lot going on, I have a lot of stress happening, but we are in a different place in our society. I'm going to try my best to help these kids. And what I really liked about it is at the very end, she convinces the new kid is about to leave. She convinces him to come back. And he's like, yeah, you should come back. It's a good place. And then you see the purifiers come out and about to shoot up the entire school, which is an awesome little story arc, I think, to add for this kind of issue. So anyways, I'm excited. Generation X, number one, pick it up. I have all four variant covers or three variant covers plus the main cover, and I love all of it. So I think it's worth it. I'll stop there.
Awesome. I'm glad it turned out to be as good as you had hoped.
Yep.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun issue.
Yeah.
All right. I have The Power of the Dark Crystal, number 3. Little backstory behind the Power of the Dark Crystal. This is an adaptation of the script that was never made, the sequel to the Dark Crystal film. Mm-hmm. So it's being done as a 12-issue maxi series. And yeah, it's written by Simon Spurrier with art by Kelly and Nicole Matthews. I really dig this series overall. It's at its third issue. The problem I'm running into right now is that in this one, the crystal shard has been broken off of the main crystal. And so that rebirths the Skeksis and the Mystics from the original movie. But the story is really not going anywhere yet. I think this is hopefully the last issue of exposition and setup to get us to the adventure.
Sure.
They introduce a whole new race, and their livelihood is dependent on having a crystal shard. But once the crystal is broken, it destroys the piece that has been created 100 years from the original Dark Crystal film. So I really like it. I like the aesthetic. It's very much a cartoon version of... Mm-hmm. The film. It has really like softness to it. The characters match what we remember. Agra is part of the story, which for Dark Crystal fans, Agra's amazing. But yeah, it's a really fun book. Issue 3 was definitely the weakest of the bunch, but here's hoping that this will just be that final bit of setup to lead us into something bigger and the adventure beginning.
Yeah. So, nice. Yeah, it looks very... I like your description of being soft and nice, and it just feels right.
Yeah, it feels like it's a softened, cartooned version of the movie. It looks great. It looks like it fits within the Dark Crystal universe, which is the best you can hope for that story.
Awesome. Mm. So. All
right. Nice.
What do you got over there, Pat?
Okay, so for my next comic, I'm going to talk about Jeff Lemire's Royal City. Which I am a huge fan of currently. So this is issue number 3, so definitely still time to pick up issues 1 and 2. And I say Jeff Lemire's Royal City because Jeff Lemire, this is his comic. He writes it, he pencils it, he does the art for it. The only other credit given in this whole comic is lettered by Steve Wands. So he puts letters in, but other than that, Jeff Lemire does everything about this. So this comic is really killing it for me in a lot of different ways because it's really just like a small town family drama, pretty much. So it takes place in this sort of like mid-sized Midwest city called Royal City. It's kind of experiencing like downfall from, you know, it used to be a big industrial town and it's kind of fallen off, as we see is a very common story these days. And it focuses on one particular family from this town, the Pike family, who just are all sorts of just really disconnected in different ways. They're all trying to live their lives and do the best they can, but they just can't get along at all. So, like, their dad, there's 3 siblings so far. There's a sister, Tara, 2 brothers, Richie and Pat, and I think a 4th brother. But the 4th brother somehow died back, way back when he was a kid, and he's haunting them. Like, not as a ghost, but more as, like, this hallucination that, like, all of them have. They kind of hear his voice in places. They see him, like, sitting across the sea from them in, like, the coffee shop. So more of, like, not like a ghost, like, ooh, I'm back to get my revenge, but more like this feeling of loss that we really experience if you've ever lost somebody, and you get like these very vivid flashes of them every now and then in certain situations. It's very surreal. A lot of times they open up with really interesting scenes. So, like, this one is actually like a dream that Tara is having, and there's just like giant radios everywhere for some reason. And I thought one of the most interesting things about this issue actually was, in the last issue, we see the brother Richie. He's kind of the guy, he never got out of the town. He's still working there in one of the mills. And in the last issue, it opens up with him. He's going on, like, a bender, pretty much. He's, like, you know, doing coke and, like, drinking a lot. And these, like, gang members come and, like, beat him up. And they're like, you owe us, like, you know, a couple grand that you borrowed from us. And, you know, we need it. Like, your time is up, pretty much. Like, you have till the end of the week to get us the money, or else, like, worse things will happen to you. And so he's walking home, and his brother Pat, who's back in town to take care of their father because he had a stroke, he picks him. He just, like, sees Richie walking down the street, picks him up, and they have this conversation. And Richie's just kind of like a dick to him, and he's like, "You don't understand my life. Like, you're this big name." Pat was an author. He wrote a book called Royal City that kind of got him a lot of attention. And so Richie's like, "Pat, you don't understand. You're like this big city white collar guy. You know, you don't understand my life. Don't try to talk to me." And then a couple pages later, we actually have this really interesting conversation between Pat and his publisher, pretty much, because the first couple issues show Pat struggling with writing his second novel. So he already has a book deal and this stuff. And so they call him up, and he's having this conversation with his publisher that's like, "We need the book now. Like, you have until the end of the month to get us the script for the book," or like the rough draft, "or else your contract is cut. You're going to have to give us back the front you gave us on, like, the advance you gave us." And so it's, like, this really interesting parallel between his, like, the two brothers. I mean, like, Richie owes gangsters money that he borrowed. And Pat owes his publisher pretty much money that he borrowed. So they're kind of in the same boat here. And neither of them... Richie obviously doesn't have the money, and, like, the last issue, it showed Pat bringing up his book and just writing chapter one. And so, like, the words chapter one.
So
he's behind in it, and definitely can't get it by the end of the month.
Right, they're not drug dealers gonna beat your, you know, kneecaps out, but still, it's similar.
But, like, career-wise, they're definitely gonna, like, you know, bust your kneecaps up for not doing that. And so... it's kind of drawing this interesting parallel, you know, the classic, like, you can take the hood out the boy, but you can't take... or you can take the boy out the hood, but you can't take the hood out the boy kind of thing. Because Pat, even though he got out, he's still stuck here mentally, and everybody's here. And it kind of ends with this really... with this really crazy drama between Tara and her wife. Tara's like a real estate developer who's trying to revitalize the city, and her husband works as like a factory foreman who's like pretty much trying to keep the city, return it to its former glory, and Tara wants to modernize it. So there's this really interesting... there's no superheroes, there's no powers, there's no sci-fi, there's nothing story. Like just a really good drama.
Nice.
So, yeah, Jeff Lemire, Royal City, go pick it up. Awesome.
Nice, I like it. Well, I'm going to be doing Rat Queens really quick, issue number 3. So it's been rebooted, and so I've been trying to get into it and see how it's going after the reboot. And I really like it. Number 3 is a good issue because they're trying to bring the comedy back, which was what made Rat Queens such a great book to begin with. And they're trying to bring the comedy back into this one, and I thought it was really good. Only thing I'm not really digging right now is the artwork for me, and that's only because Steven Sajak did the artwork at some point in time, and Steven Sajak is like, he's like the one for me. I really want to put him on the podcast or something because he's my favorite artist out there, period.
He's going
to
be doing Aquaman as of issue 25.
Is he really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, then I don't have to read Aquaman. I have to read Aquaman because of that. So he's so fantastic. Anyways, great book. Definitely pick it up and read it. The comedy is in there. It's hilarious. And all I'm going to say is that someone has sex with the spirit of a spirit stone, and it's awesome. And when it happens, it's amazing. So pick up Rat Queens number 3. You'll love it.
All right. For my last book, I'll be doing Venom 150. This is the special anniversary issue. So there's actually 3 different stories in this. But for the main story, it's written by Mike Costa with art by Trad Moore. This was my big surprise for the week. I honestly didn't intend to pick this up. I was going to look through it, but I had to pick up the variant cover by James Stokoe after I had read this, because this book is just... This was like a great reintroduction to Venom. They frame the relationship of the symbiote and Eddie Brock like a love story, and like a bad love story. I want to read like the little synopsis intro that Marvel Comics are doing right now, but I'm just going to read a part of it. For a time, they were happily living separately, but when fate offered them a chance to reunite, they found themselves unable to resist. Together or apart, Eddie and the symbiote will always be Venom. And there's this sick, like, abusive relationship that they have with each other, because it's almost as if Eddie wants to be some sort of a anti-hero, but the symbiote wants to tell him that that's not what he needs, so the symbiote pushes him to be more violent and more brutal. And this art is incredible. Trad Moore, I've never actually got the opportunity to read a book that he's done. I'm a fan of his art. It's really weird. It's a weird anime aesthetic, or manga aesthetic, excuse me. And there's one sequence where he transforms and, like, vomits out the symbiote. And it's just beautifully disgusting. And it's so intense, and it really feels like they want to be together. They want to hold each other, and yeah, it's just so weird and so dark. It's definitely, this was a big surprise for me. I don't know if I'll continue reading, the book, but based on this, I want to give it a shot. That's been really cool. That the whole relationship aspect, that it's not just, I'm this Spider-Man anti-clone thing, and it's actually more about how demented their relationship is and how abusive the symbiote is.
Which would make for a great movie one day.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Potentially.
Potentially. Well, we shall see.
Sony film execs, if you're listening right now.
Yeah.
Pick up issue number 150.
Venom. Oh, and this also, 150 being one of the first titles to move to its the new numbering, although Marvel is saying this is not part of the legacy event, but it's continuing its numerical history for the Venom series. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. You're up,
Matt. Nice. So I guess for my last reviews, I'm going to do a quick variation on Leander's Hate It, Love It. And I'm going to do a Hate It, Meh About It. So first, we got American Gods by Neil Gaiman. Hate it. I was so excited for this. Big fan of Neil Gaiman. Story, absolutely, absolutely garbage. I'm sorry, Neil Gaiman, if you're listening. I love you to death, but the story sucks. The art sucks. I want to watch the TV show because it's supposed to be really good, but the comic, just not good at all. Taking it off my list after issue number 3.
Yeah.
And then meh about it was Black Panther issue number 14. This has been killing it for me recently. Like, the first 12 issues, so good. 13, introducing a new track, talking about Wakanda's past instead of where it's potentially going in the future. Issue 14 was just kind of meh about it. One of the only interesting thing about this issue is we get a Council of the Dead, pretty much. The Black Panther is sitting in a room talking to all the past iterations of the Black Panther and the rulers of Wakanda. I'm really interested to see where this particular storyline goes. But this is only like, 5 or 6 pages of the issue. And I thought it could have been all about this, honestly.
Yeah.
And then what I really thought was intriguing about this actually was a letter from the letters page. So on the letters page, it's just a one-page letters page, and there's only 2 letters, and one of them takes up pretty much the whole thing. I've not seen a letter this long, and it's there for good reasons. So this guy writes in specifically to Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author, pretty much saying, and he goes on this really interesting spiel about how Wakanda is really interesting because it's such an African perspective. And this writer, he mentions at one point that he is African American himself, so he loves that representation of it and seeing like these roots represented. But with the end of arc, the last arc, Wakanda's going to a democracy and overthrowing the king, and his big qualm with it, he says he's putting it down because he doesn't see this, he sees this as Western values being forced on a traditionally African narrative, which makes a lot of sense. Democracy is thought of as this Western idea, and he thinks it would be better if Black Panther sticks to its roots, being very tribal, being very monarchy-oriented, and which makes sense in a certain way. And the way Ta-Nehisi Coates responds to it is just really amazing, though. Kind of tells him to do it, like, just a, you know, not in a, this is going to sound condescending coming from me, but he pretty much tells them, you know, you should really look into the history of democracy because it's not just a Western ideal, and yada, yada, yada. So, very interesting. I would definitely recommend reading the letters page of issue 14 if you don't read the rest of the issue. Very compelling dialogue between these two, people.
Nice.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to quickly do three comics, and I'll do my fast way. So, X-Men Blue, number 4. I know, why is it in my bin still? I get it. But I actually liked X-Men Blue, number 4. I thought it was interesting. I'm probably still not going to keep the title, but I actually enjoyed number 4 more than I enjoyed 1, 2, and 3. So, again, it kind of goes to sometimes you should probably keep a title in your bin long enough to see if you really like it or not. I think 4 is the right number, so I'm gonna drop it, but I hope for the best for those who keep on, because number 4 wasn't too bad. Harley Quinn, number 20, DC. So I only picked up Harley Quinn because of Injustice, number 2, and so Harley Quinn is my character that I fight with. So like, let me support her and pick up her comic, too. Not digging it, not liking it. It's cool. I don't like the art that much, and the storyline is about this future Batman, maybe, coming to deal with Harley Quinn for something that she may or may not ever do. And so, I get it, I appreciate it, I'm not into time travel anymore, period. Maybe I'm not into X-Men Blue, because time travel, like, the fact that they're even here is time travel oriented. Mm-hmm. I'm done with time travel. Eliminate it from Marvel and DC forever, please. I don't want to see it for like 10 years. I don't even want to know it exists because it really ruins things that I like, you know? I don't like it. It's ruining things for me.
That's actually one of the reasons I dropped America. I was really excited for Marvel's America Chavez solo run, and that's the reason I dropped it, actually. She starts traveling through time, and it's just too much, and it's unnecessary.
There should be repercussions to it. I think that's
Doesn't... You can't just jump into all these different things in like one panel per decade and not have any repercussions for that. If you're going to do a time travel story, it has to be a time travel story.
Yes. That might be one of the highlights of the button, is I think traveling through time is showing them things that have shown that there's a breakdown occurring because of that. So.
Well, good. Yeah. Everything needs to die, because I'm tired of time travel. So Marvel, DC, Image, I don't care who you are, stop with the time travel. I don't need parallel universes happening every time you go to a new time frame.
Except for Green Valley.
Except for Green Valley, which is amazing. Image, you keep doing that. And then last but not least is Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, which I will give a shout-out to Pat, because I would not have picked this up otherwise. So here's my thing, though. I liked it. I don't have time to put it in my bin. I think it's not worthy to go into my bin, but I liked it. So I don't know how I feel about the tension I'm having about this issue, because issue number 19 was good. The coloring, the art was fine. I liked all of it. The story was fine. I was happy with that, too. And the fact that she discovers this moon, and I really liked, personally, I thought it was a big link to Guardians of the Galaxy. That right now, they're going with this kind of, like, ego, being a planet size, whatever. Now you have a moon size consciousness that is aware. And Ego does show up in Moon Girl number 19, which I thought was pretty cool, but you barely see him, but you have to be looking for him to know he's there. So I don't know if this is his daughter. I don't know what the deal is, but Ego and the moon are right next to each other. Mm-hmm. But Moon Girl doesn't even know that she's a moon-sized consciousness until she's on the moon and walking around. But anyways, I recommend picking up number 19, read it, and you make a decision whether or not you want to put it in your bin, because I'm struggling with it right now. I don't know if I do or don't, but it's worth picking up and reading to figure it out. So
I'd actually say I'm a huge fan of Moon Girl, Devil Dinosaur, and I will say this one, it was kind of a low point as far as, like, introductions. I'm pretty sure, like, with the way the story is going, it's going to get a lot more compelling, but this particular issue itself was not necessarily probably one of the best of the series.
And if it wasn't for the fact that you reviewed and let me know that she was announced as the smartest human being, you know, that helped, because they referenced it in this comic in issue number 19. Mm-hmm. And I think it helped to know that there was this huge arc beforehand that was probably a lot going on. And so they need to, like, calm her down, because she's a kid. She can't be, like, in immense adventures every single issue and then be expected to continue doing that and not get exhausted. And so, yeah,
because she was in, like, she's been in, like, the past, like, three of the past, like, major Marvel comic crossovers, and she is just a 9-year-old kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
She needs to eat her mac and cheese once
in a while. Right. She has to go to school, so. Anyways, I think that'll wrap up our issue number 2.5 of Capes and Scowls West. So please continue to subscribe, listen to us, find us out on Facebook. Well, Capes and Scowls Original is on Facebook, so like that first. And eventually, when we get our own Facebook page, we'll let you know where to go to find Capes and Scowls West on Facebook. So, but for now, I'll say goodbye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.